Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast from the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vow, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how are you doing?
Fine, Jack. Glad to see you.
Glad to see you. We once again broadcast from your palatial estate.
We have a new studio, don't we?
The Manor on the Hill.
We've got to think of a name for this place.
We do. We have to come up with something fascinating, like Russell Kirk had Piety Hill, and
probably has to do with something with hill, since it's such a beautiful hill where our house is on here.
I have a wonderful view. I'm looking out the bay windows just now.
It's
very lovely.
Outside. Yeah.
Everyone who's listening is just excruciated right now. They may be in their car, stuck in traffic. Oh, you have a nice view. How good for you. Welcome to the podcast.
They are welcome. They're welcome to come by and see our view anytime. Mm. We're hoping that this house will be a good place for study and for students to come and relate and maybe even live. We've got room enough for, a student once in a while.
Yeah.
I think this ought to be a good place. It's got several nice places to sit. We're going to make that room there into the library, and you can sit in there, and you can sit here in the den, as we're doing, and you can. There's some nice places out in the back for a fire pit and a few chairs, and if the weather is like it is today, it'll be perfect.
So what... It's so wonderful we have this house and we have the center.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's a dream come true, regardless of the struggles of trying to run this thing sometimes, with the ramshackle skeleton crew we have. it's a privilege to be able to do it. And often it seems like a miracle, but it seems that there is a need for these type of smaller things that provide something that most people don't feel like they're being provided elsewhere. There have been articles written about it before that for some reason little groups like us, or in a larger sense, smaller little colleges, mm-hmm. are actually getting higher enrollment than bigger universities because people are flocking to them because it seems like they have something they don't have. Or like little groups like us can like pop up and, can have regular people all the time.
Yeah.
And most people attach it to an old bugbear and an old boogeyman. I don't know if boogeyman is the right word, but an old bugbear, which is, for you D&D fans out there, it is the so-called, quote-unquote, decline of the liberal arts
right.
in academia. Now, people have heard that before, or, they maybe have heard some version of it before, and I can't help but sense that when we say something like the decline of the liberal arts, people's eyes glaze over just a bit, because that almost sounds like a raised pinky kind of statement decline of the liberal arts. Because I don't even think people know what the liberal arts mean.
You have to say it with an English accent.
The liberal arts. I don't even know. That wasn't English. That was like Swiss French or something. My apologies to both countries. there is like liberal, they don't know what that means.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I wonder if even the defenders of liberal arts know what it means or why it's there.
It does seem like whenever you speak about the liberal arts as a major, people's eyes glaze over. It sounds, I think, to most people, and it has for most the better part of my life, I think it sounds like to most people as though we're saying undecided.
Yeah.
I'm an undecided major. I'm a liberal arts major. That's the same thing.
Yeah, that's kind of that was the joke even in the liberal arts college I was growing. I went to. It was like, well, if you did liberal arts, it was like, well, if you don't know what else to do, do a liberal arts degree.
Sign up for liberal arts.
That wasn't always true. There was always like a person or two who did it deliberately because they wanted the education. But there was that joke.
Right. 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 Well, it was like that when I was an undergrad too, and that's many years ago now. But there is a meaning to the word liberal, obviously, free, and it refers, I think, more not to like free thinking necessarily, but I think it refers to the two kinds of education that you used to get as a Greek. In the Greek world, there was there was education for the free man that they called liberal education, and there was education for the slave.
Right.
And the education for the slave was called techne. Which they meant vocational training. Mm-hmm. You learn techniques. Slaves in the Greek world did an awful lot of very intelligent work. translations and tutoring and
building architecture.
Architecture, absolutely.
Good
shipbuilding, accounting. There were a lot of things that it wasn't just manual labor. But nevertheless, there was a distinction between what the free student would do and what the slave would do. And it was the difference between vocational training and what we now call liberal arts training, which is to train you to think well, to reason well, and to know history and to know how to apply history to the present day. History of literature, history of warfare, history of politics.
So what you're saying, Hodges, is liberal arts is founded in imperialism.
It's clearly imperial. It's only slave owners and people who were working for Alexander the Great that were taking over the world.
So we're allowed to have it.
Maybe we should kill off liberal arts education. Maybe that's what it's imperialistic at its roots.
It's imperialistic to think clearly.
Imperialistic to think clearly. That's a thought. Well, it does seem like there's a problem today in the universities. Many people have written about it. Our Victor Davis Hanson, of course, has written books about it and articles about it. You can find those in City Journal and National Review and various places. But his concern, of course, is that we're not teaching people how to think anymore. And I'm just interested in discussing, since we're both in academia, I used to teach college, now I teach the center, of course, and you are working on your PhD, and you are teaching for the center, too, and have taught college for many years. What do you suppose we could do? Let's talk about what we could do to reignite that kind of flame in the next generation. It's a matter of, we were talking before we started the podcast about how we teachers are really waiting in a sense for the spirit to fall. We teach the things that we need to teach in order to set the stage so that God can actually step in and inspire people.
Yeah, that's the frustrating part about a teacher, being a teacher, educator, whatever, or an academic or an intellectual or whatever. The frustrating part about it, if you really think, is not like all the grading and stuff and trouble students and things like that necessarily. That's annoying and has its own issues that should be dealt with. I think one of the fundamental issues, if you're a teacher who really believes in what you're teaching and thinks that it's important and think that it's valuable, is you understand that you can't make people like it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't. That's not on you.
That's right.
That's what you mean by the spirit to fall. I put it that we're basically, we're less like teachers passing down some sort of like informational knowledge and more like priests at the temple waiting for the fire to fall.
Exactly.
We have no idea when it's going to fall. We know it falls because it fell for us and we've seen it fall for others, but it's coming and going. I can't remember who it was, whether it was Sidney or Shelley, one of the two poets, wrote a defense of poetry saying that it's like the inspiration for poetry, that like that inspiration comes like a wind on a hot coal, and you never know when it's coming.
Yeah.
And it's in some ways that moment is that. Now you live for that moment because that's the moment where something happens, where the student comes in contact with something, their eyes are open, and a whole world is open to them. And it's much deeper and richer and wider world than, like, say, wokeness is or something like that, where you're aware of a very specific, politically motivated, ideological framework. Instead, now the whole world opens up to you, and things can never be the same. The way that you look at them can never be the same. You really have, as a teacher, almost zero control over that. Your role in the classroom is to like set up an environment that is conducive for that fire to fall.
But whether
it falls or not, no matter how hard you try, I mean, it may not fall, or it may not all the way you think, or with the people you think, and in the limitations you have, maybe you find your ability to make a conducive environment frustrating. But it is about making that conducive environment, I think that's what has always made, I think, the liberal arts important, which we might want to back up and say, what do we mean by the liberal arts? Are we talking about like specific classes or a specific kind of curriculum or a general idea? Like, what do we mean in this room when we say liberal arts?
That's good. Of course, I did just define it in terms of the kind of education, but we didn't
to make a specific think, right?
thing. Yeah, make
specific.
You think. But to make you think, there's several things that you have to be able to do, right? You have to be able to read well, and you have to make sense of arguments, mm-hmm. and you have to be able to craft arguments and send them back to be compelling in a debate, in a discussion. Mm-hmm. So those three things together made up the trivium, right? It was
right.
learning how to manage grammar and to make sense of arguments in logic, and then to be able to speak compellingly to an audience in rhetoric. And of course, that has a direct connection for Christians to the fact that Jesus himself calls himself the Word, and so language and the Word are tied together. And the fact that he's revealed himself to us in a scripture means that there's a word that has to be deciphered. And those three tools, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, can help you unpack what it is that God has said so that you learn something about literary devices and poetic devices and different kinds of literature, narrative literature and didactic literature and poetic literature and so on. And then on the other hand, God reveals himself in the creation itself. And so the way to the ancients knew about understanding God's revelation in what they call general revelation is through understanding numbers. And so you learn about arithmetic and you learn about geometry to compare shapes and relations. And you learn about astronomy specifically in order to know distances and the cosmos, and then finally music that is supposed to teach you, or that does teach you about ratios that all have to do with numbers. And if you can understand the beauty of numbers and how they work, then you can unlock some of the secrets of the natural world that God has made, and that reveals him too, just mm-hmm. like an artwork would reveal the artist.
I think it's that unlocking thing that is... I was going to say, it's an unlocking thing that is key. You see what I did there?
I like that.
See,
I like
that's
that.
The key to, like, so I think that's why it's connected to the fire falling thing. Mm-hmm. Whether you strictly teach those seven things, or whether you teach variations of them, or what have you, the point of being able to learn how to think is that there's a goal to that.
Right. That's right. It's a means to a further end.
Means to a further end,
right.
Which is to, at least from a Christian perspective, is to unlock the... Well, what would you call it? Like the truth of, like, God. Like,
right.
To unlock, like, the reality
how
of God.
How he's revealed himself. We can't possibly know an infinite God unless he's revealed himself to us, right? So since we're finite, there's no way we can know him. Kant was right that there's a numinous that can't be known unless God has revealed himself to us. And
right.
if he did, then we have to be able to learn the language by which he's given us this revelation.
So from a Christian perspective, it would be about... learning to think clearly so that you could begin to unlock God's revelation.
That's right.
Whatever it may be.
That's right.
If you were not a Christian, at the very least, it would be about learning to think clearly so that you could unlock reality in
right.
some way. And that's what
right.
I meant by it's deeper and bigger than wokeness. Wokeness is too tied up with Marxist intersectional thinking, which is a very narrow groove, which we don't have to talk about that. But the point is that it's not nearly as big or as deep or as wide as unlocking all the ability to see into all the depths of reality in
that's,
some way.
That's right. And part of that depth, you know, you and I did a series of lectures, just to remind our listeners, on the importance of the imagination in learning and reasoning and revelation. And if there's an invisible world to know that can be known by way of the material world, then you have to learn how to handle metaphors. Right? Because metaphoric thinking, like you just said about the lock and the key, you almost have to have a good liberal arts education to get the joke. Mm. It's a small joke, but it wasn't intended. I mean, I'm not knocking the joke, but I mean, it was a moment of metaphoric relation that was a pun, but that's only a pun if you can understand metaphorically, right? So if you see the world as only sort of material... not seeing through the world, as it were, to the invisible things that it points to, then you really don't know the truth. You don't know right. the whole situation. And that's what I think a liberal arts education was intended to have. Now, as the enthusiasm for a spiritual life, for a relationship to the Christian God, has dwindled in our day, I think we also have... lost a step in our metaphoric thinking.
Right.
And so we don't really see the point, as it were, about thinking in metaphors. There's nothing there to refer to if you push it far enough.
Right. I think it would be better to say that a lack of enthusiasm for a rational spiritual life. Because there's plenty of people, a spiritual, like, oh yes, I'm very spiritual. Or, you know, I'm in tune with the vibes of the universe,
sure,
or whatever.
Sure.
But that's always purely subjective, purely, they say it's purely mysterious, which is a way of saying it's purely nothing, so I can make it whatever I want. And the idea of a rational spiritual thing, that there is a numinous reality that is actually knowable.
That's knowable, exactly.
Knowable,
great distinction.
That's something people don't have an enthusiasm for, because for probably a litany of reasons, but there's a sense that if the spiritual world is kind of a place that needs to be a blank canvas where I can just sort of paint whatever sort of justification for my behavior that I can, whether we're talking about theologically or even metaphysically, you know, let's set up something that justifies whatever I want. It's usually the material world where, like, okay, well, here I have to be rational about this, although there's some ways in which the non-rationality is bleeding into that.
It's bleeding into the physical understanding. I think so too.
But the point being that it's not the desire, the lack of enthusiasm for spiritual, but for the rational spiritual life, probably what, like, Anselm, I think it was, would call, like, the ratio fide, you know, like the rational faith.
Faith that's reasonable. That's right. And when we use the word rational, we're not talking about rationalism.
No.
Right. Just to make a distinction. Reason is a great thing. Rationalism, on the other hand, is not. So that leads us back to what's supposed to be taught in the university. And the problem with the university today, of course, is that they claim to be giving you classes in, say, literature or in history or in languages or whatever. Mm. But what they often give instead is a kind of ideologically driven reinterpretation of language or literature or history, don't you think?
I think so. This is where it gets complicated for me, or complex. Maybe I should have said frustrating. That's my word, right?
I can't go a podcast without you being frustrated about something.
I've been in, you know, the graduate level sort of classes that have an ideological bent, and the books that we read have the ideological bent.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, been in there, but I could not help shake the feeling that, in a sense, that stuff mattered to people. Like, it mattered to people in a very concrete way. You know, what happens to people, you know, the exploited or the whatever or something like that. It matters how they get represented and whether they can represent themselves. So there is the catch is that sometimes I don't think it's all just, I don't think either of us have said this. But I worry there's some people out there more curmudgeonly and a bit fatalistic types who think that it's all just one thing. Even the ideological classes still get students and still get even enthusiastic students, and not just because they're a bunch of, you know, shills and sheep following along with the ideological Pied Piper. It's because something about that ideology touches concretely life in some way. Mm-hmm. We said the rational and the spiritual. Like, it's supposed to, that's kind of like how we are, that's how it's supposed to be. You know, there's like the spirit, there's a spiritual reality and it's knowable. It's mysterious, but it's also knowable at the same time. It's a paradox. You have to hold them together.
Right.
Victor Davis Hanson, who had written, I think he said, written an article or two. He's written a lot of articles about liberal arts stuff. In a couple we read recently, he seem to focus on that there's two main forces that are kind of causing liberal arts education, and even the university as we understand it, to sort of collapse and crumble. One is an increase on vocationalism, is what he calls it, an increased focus on vocational techne type stuff, which in a democratic society anybody can go to. As I increase on that, which is directly a tie.
And by the way, let me just interject. I think that's a very good thing to have.
Yeah.
Okay? I'm not in any way against traditional vocational training in any field. It works for air conditioning repairs and car repairs, but it works for law and medicine too.
Yeah.
All those, in my mind, are kind of the same. They're very specific, very hands-on, very detailed to learn that particular field. And you need that in a culture.
Right. So I think that's why Hanson calls it vocationalism, which is this attitude that a vocational education is superior to university education.
Right.
Mainly because it makes money.
Right.
And it's probably not nearly as expensive or long to learn it. So there's vocationalism that is applied to it. And the other side of it was the ideological narrowing of the humanities, where humanities are simply basically different varieties of grievance studies.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if those two things, which I think are true. Like I said, I think sometimes it's complicated. I think sometimes even in the grievance studies, you still find some contact with reality, because how else would they get any students if it wasn't doing something that they're tapping into? Tapping into correctly and with bad results, but still tapping into. Still, I can't help but look at the vocationalism side and the ideological narrowness side and seeing in it, in that situation, that is not a context conducive to causing the flame, because what you need is the rational and the spiritual, and the vocationalism and the ideologicalism, let's put it that way, the reductionism, let's put it that way on that side, are against those two things respectively.
Mm-hmm.
So like, put it, we can unpack this more if you want, but just the simple version is vocationalism is in a sense against the spiritual side of things, because it's like, look, all that heady, highfalutin stuff is just nonsense and jargon anyway. What matters is getting a job, making money, you know, putting bread on the table, things that are important, but they're the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
And if you want to do all that highfalutin stuff, do it on your own time as a hobby,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, kind of the secular view of like religion. Like, if you want to do religion on your own time, that's fine, but mm-hmm. don't you dare bring it in the voting booth mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a backhanded compliment to it. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the ideological thing is almost a denial of the rational. There was a very good way that Hansen put it in one of his articles. He talked about that. It basically, the ideological narrowing of the humanities basically destroys inductive reasoning by pure deductive reasoning, and that there's just a bunch of general principles you're just supposed to accept and without question, mm-hmm. and then everything gets seen through that light. And in doing so, the ability to rationally engage with things gets limited, narrowed, and atrophies in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So in some way, there needs to be a restoration in the classroom of both the rational and the spiritual, of the mysterious, but also that it's knowable at the same time. I just said a lot of things really fast. If we want to unpack it or not, I don't know.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I mean, as a Christian, I would think that there are a few sort of axioms that we want to take and embrace, not without question. I think they're reasonable, but they're...
That's the catch.
Uh-huh. It's important. I mean, there are such things as axioms, but look, once embraced an axiom that's true, looking back on it, you see how it fits reasonably, don't you?
Right.
Well, I think that's for this sort of thing to happen, for that combination, as you say, of the rational and the spiritual to happen, mm-hmm. academia would have to at least be willing to reconsider the spiritual.
Yes.
And I think that may be a hard thing to accomplish, don't you think?
It might be. I don't know.
I'm not saying that there aren't some teachers that already do it and do it well.
I've heard weird rumblings from people who are in like theology and philosophy, well, philosophy mainly, that an interest in God and theological concepts is slowly starting to come back in. And usually in academic worlds, it starts with the philosophers and kind of trickles down to everybody else.
It certainly does.
So.
Well, maybe that would be an encouraging sign.
Maybe it's moving in that way.
Yeah.
I can't help but feel sometimes, I mean, I think it is going to move in that way eventually, because what you have in its place instead is basically a wasteland and desert compared mm-hmm. to like some sort of rich spiritual depth mm-hmm. in some way. We're living in the ruins of rationalism, basically, whether you take it to its most rigid scientism view of things, or old curmudgeonly Marxist material view of things, or you take it to its most absurd postmodern, post-structural, deconstructive, performative, transgressive kind of view of things. It's all just the ruins of rationalism mm-hmm. in some way. Mm-hmm. And at some point, people, even now, I think, are just sick and tired of it. So I do think it's going to go that way. But I think on the way there, the sort of rationalist bell can't be unrung. It's always mm-hmm. going to be there. And there's people who will like bring in spiritualism, but they don't want to bring in God. Or, you know, well, we'll bring in like spiritual mysteries, but just as sort of a toolbox, we can just kind of look in and see what tools we want, or like a quarry we can mine and take what we want, leave what we don't want. Well, I really like this idea of like, you know, incarnation as a principle, but I don't need Christ for that.
Well, and that shows up in those who were arguing for a kind of mythological foundation for society.
Yes.
Right? Kind of Jungian thing, where maybe I don't believe specific religious texts, but I believe in the idea that we need a kind of metaphysical foundation for
society. Yeah, I think that's why I say, like, Jordan Peterson, for example, so popular, which I always hesitate to bring him up because he's so controversial to people.
Yeah.
This is neither an endorsement or a denigration of him. I'm just saying there's a reason he gets so popular, and it's not just because he's actually willing to talk about things or to question the unquestionable axioms of academia. It's also because it's in addition to all that he introduces a spiritual element, that Jungian mythological archetypal thing that is way richer and deeper and more powerful than any sort of materialist race, class, gender triad that
right.
you could do.
Right.
Now, the problem with Peterson is, well, he introduces a mythological archetypal framework, but I don't know. It almost feels, you sometimes wonder, does he actually believe that stuff is there, or is he just positing as concepts that are useful? Does he really, I mean, it's always like the question, do you believe in God? And he always is like, what does that mean? You know, or something like that, which is fine. I mean,
I've heard him say, I act as though there were a God.
Right. It's that kind of idea.
That kind of sidestepping the question. And yet, seeing the value of there being right. a God and what good it would do for reason and for society.
For the flaw, the sort of like the big sort of issue or flaw with his thinking is that you don't know, or it doesn't seem like there's any, does he really believe there is any spiritual substance to all this stuff? Or is it just cool concepts that ultimately arrive out of biology, but they're just cool concepts and we kind of need them?
Yeah.
I feel like at some point people are going to be like, look, if there's no real spiritual substance to this, then they're just empty concepts, and why do they matter? There has to be actual spiritual substance that comes in some way.
That's right. I think you and I would agree to that. I'm not sure he would yet.
No.
But I think he actually was going to argue that a lot of these things come up out, specifically, as you say, out of biological realities. And then they get sort of transformed into mythological language so that we can communicate them. But their source is really in a kind of evolutionary process over millions of years.
But even there, and this is not to contradict you, but I just suddenly realized, even there, there's a touch of the rational spiritual. Because
mm-hmm.
it's like, look, this thing is grounded in something knowable, which is biology, and yet the way it's permutated and gone out and the sort of concepts that it presents are big, and how they fit and how they actually work are just mysterious. You
right.
know, it's mysterious
right.
how those things actually worked out, and it's kind of a miracle. That type of teaching can get people inspired, right? They can
and
inspire.
It does, doesn't
it? It does.
It generates huge crowds.
It does.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe we should invite him on one time.
I would love to do that.
Guess
I would love to have him on. Wouldn't
oh my
that
gosh,
be great?
That would blow us
Maybe
up.
We should talk about it. well, I'm very encouraged by the thought that you just gave that maybe philosophically we're going to get closer to God, and that's going to seep down into the sort of day-to-day academic world again in the next some decades or something. I would love to think that's the case.
Sure.
I find that I'm less optimistic about that happening through the vehicle of the modern university.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's one of the reasons we're doing the Center for Western Studies, right? Because
sure.
it's an alternative kind of approach. Not an alternative approach, it's an alternative vehicle.
Yeah.
It's a different sort of
road altogether.
Yeah. I mean, it's trying to accomplish what I think the university wanted to accomplish to a certain degree anyway, not an entire university education, but a lot of the enthusiasm for the liberal arts should be found here. But it's a return, really, to a medieval kind of pedagogy, where you have one-on-one conversations with a tutor,
yeah.
and you have lectures that you attend, and then discuss them all, and then make connections all the time between what you're reading in literature, the ideas you're getting there, and what you're hearing in the history at the same time. For example, I'm going to be talking today about Shakespeare this afternoon, about Shakespeare, and about A Midsummer Night's Dream in particular. We're going to be reading Hamlet and King Lear and A Midsummer Night's Dream this semester. Mm. And
light reading.
And the fascinating connections between what was going on in history in the 16th century, latter part of the 16th century, mm. when Shakespeare was alive, the influence of the Reformation, the division in England between the Catholics and the Protestants, and all the wars that went on there, Mary and her support of the Catholics, followed by Elizabeth and her support of the Protestants, and all of that going on, is I think in some ways revealed in the plays that Shakespeare's writing. Mm. So we see it in Hamlet, and I'm going to point out some places I think in the Midsummer Night's Dream that are specifically biblical and actually are intended to heal the divisions between them in Christendom. I think Shakespeare actually had a desire to see that rift healed. And I'm getting it really only from his plays. I'm not thinking about his biography as much. But anyway, my point is there's so much about politics and history and wars and religion and all of that that you find in literature. Mm. And those connections, I think, are exciting to find. Mm-hmm. They're reasonable and clear-headed when they are pointed out and discussed. So that's the sort of stuff where I'm really interested in seeing happen in our education, and that's what I hope a liberal arts education would be,
right,
in the universities. So what I find, though, is that when I talk to college students, I don't find the kind of hunger for that. You mentioned earlier the crowds that flock to the Jordan Peterson kind of like rock concerts almost,
yeah.
You know, he and whoever.
Whoever he's with.
He's with Shapiro sometimes. Who is it that he, David Rubin. Dave Rubin, I bet. Yeah. He does some things, goes around the country in the world with Dave Rubin, who agree on some things and very much not on other things. But it's great conversation, and it seems to be really enthusiastic for people. People come from all around to hear them talk. But what I find on the general level, just speaking to college students directly, it's almost as though they have been inoculated against the enthusiasm that we're talking about for
sure.
A liberal arts education. Maybe they've been given an ideological spin on the liberal arts so much that they don't want to pursue it anymore, or they don't find it exciting, or maybe it's that whole vocationalism idea that the education is really for the purpose of getting a job, and I don't see how reading Dante is going to help me with my career.
I think there is a third thing,
okay,
that is also important, because I think the vocationalism and the ideological reductionism are two big parts. But, you know, vocationalism, you know, going to a vocational school and wanting, like, well, I need to, like, put food on the table and have the skills of,
yeah,
does not necessitate a sort of meh about, like, liberal arts stuff. I mean, one of our center students, when he got done with the center, he wasn't going to go to college. He mm-hmm. just went back to his parents' bakery, right? To learn that.
That's right.
But there was no despisement. He loved everything that we did. He was going to keep doing it, but he could do his vocational job as well. And he could just do that. And he would probably take over the bakery when he grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, ideological reductionism doesn't mean that the person who takes it is even going to agree with the ideology. They may just look, sit there and just be like, my gosh, this is boring, or this is preachy, or this is sermonizing, or they've heard it a million times, or this is exactly what my parents and my church camp counselor said would happen. And so their eyes glaze over because they don't see anything. There's nothing there,
yeah,
right? Meaning that maybe they never even got really exposed to the real thing yet. I think the third thing, besides the vocationalism and the ideological reductionism, is that I don't think we have enough professors, and I think this is mostly on the idea, actually I think this is majoritively on the ideological reductionism side, because I think the vocationalism is a reaction against that.
Mm.
I don't think we have, in the humanities, very many professors, or popular ones, or famous ones, who give a hoot about the humanities at all.
Hmm.
What they care about is their ideology. And the humanities is a means to that end. Mm-hmm. If you go into a class with a post-colonialist, they don't want you to appreciate any of the books that they're reading or the art that they're looking at. They want you to become good anti-imperialists like they are. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's like you go into a literature class and what you get is an ideological class. I don't even say ideological indoctrination, because it could be like if this was a philosophy class and you're allowed to argue about things, or this was like, look, this is an ideology class and here's the worldview, let's talk about it. That's one thing. But it's like a bait and switch. Uh-huh. I'm told I'm going to go in here and learn about great art or great literature or something. And maybe you go into it with a little bit of enthusiasm because you kind of like, you know, ooh, this is going to be about English literature and Edmund Spencer's going to be into it. I remember I read that little children's book that was a shortening of his Fairy Queen. It was about a dragon and a knight. That sounds cool. And you go in there and it's all about, you know, post-third wave feminism's take on transgenderism in Edmund Spencer. And you may sit there and you may be like, look, I'm fine with feminism, okay, but I thought this was going to be about dragons. You know, or, right. I thought this was going to be about Spencer. There's this, I get more and more a sense, sometimes they do against themselves, but I think there's a lot of professors out there who teach the humanities don't care about the humanities. They care about their ideology. And as such, we don't have enough students who run into professors who love the thing itself for its own sake. This is the bedrock of my pedagogy, and it has been for a long time. And I've said it before. It was the opening, like, little prologue-y thing to Blue Like Jazz, which has nothing to do with teaching, as far as I could tell. But it's just that opening sequence where the author, whose name escapes me, Donald Miller. He said he was in Seattle or he was somewhere, and he said he hated jazz music because jazz music doesn't resolve. But then he saw a guy on the street playing jazz on a saxophone. And the guy, like, played and never, like, opened his eyes. He just played his heart out. He said after that, he loved jazz music. Mm. And he ended it by saying, sometimes you have to watch someone love something before you can learn to love it yourself. Mm. And I think that is essential to any teaching, that what you're teaching, you love the thing that you're actually teaching. And I think that's why the enthusiasm can still happen in even ideologically reductionist classes, because the professors love their ideology.
Yeah. Yeah.
And someone may get inspired by that. But if you're going in there expecting to, like, love the literature, then you get disappointed or you get let down or you're like, or that happens consistently. You're just like, well, I guess literature is just a treasure trove for things I don't care about. Mm-hmm. I remember one of our former...
There's the inoculation.
Yes. One of our former teachers, the late John Walker, said when he was in graduate school, he took a class on, like, English poetry or something like that. And the professor who taught it was a lady. She was a feminist critic, and everything she read was through the lens of, like, feminist theory. And he said she was a great professor. You know, it was really engaging, but everything was through that feminist lens, which means it seems she cared more about feminism than actually the poetry, except for George Herbert. He said, for some reason, when it came to that poetry, She could do a feminist reading of it, sure, but it's almost like that wasn't the point.
Yeah.
It was like George Herbert was good in and of himself.
Yeah.
And she would be like, look, I'm not a Christian or anything, but my gosh, like, that guy had something. I don't know what it is. That kind of teaching is the stuff that students, if they won't perk up and listen to, at the very least, that's the kind of thing that creates the conducive environment, is they see you genuinely loving something. I mean, I said we're like priests at the temple waiting for the fire to fall. Think about how much a religion can be destroyed through mere formalism.
Oh my gosh.
You know, priest is just there and they do the thing, but they're just doing it, going through the motions, empty of whatever. Or how if the priest does the thing, but it's for the sake of something else, like this temple is an example of patriarchy or something like that, how you'll start caring about the other thing rather than the actual temple.
Right,
when you see your priest, or in a more contemporary setting, I guess, if you see a preacher get up there and they speak with a kind of sincere, convicted joy or pain or something, you may not understand what they're talking about. You may not even fully agree, but you're kind of like, whatever that guy or that person is on, I want to be on it. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that gets missing is that I wonder how many people in major universities, because I'm sure there's plenty of people all across the country who do this, but in major universities, I'm curious how many professors of the humanities actually care about the humanities mm-hmm. and instead of actually caring about some ideological apparatus for which the humanities is just a quarry to mine and, you know, pull out little things that you need.
So some people might say that it's because they don't love the humanities, and I guess that's what you're saying, but it's not so much just that they don't love the humanities, it's that they do love something else more.
Yes.
And that becomes the point of the lecture or the point of the study.
Chesterton said...
I think you've got a point there.
You remember Chesterton?
Chesterton?
Yeah, Chesterton.
What does he do?
Chesterton B. Arthur.
He was a president.
Yes, he was.
He was an American president. He was,
he was the jolliest president ever, which is why we don't ever remember him. Chesterton said that men didn't love Rome because it was great. Rome was great because they loved it.
Yeah.
But he said that Pimlico, like in London, could be as glorious as Rome, but people would just love it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
The thing that gets love gets the attention and the glory, and it's something about all this ideological critical theory that rose big in the 80s and went forward. People loved that. The professors who taught that loved that for whatever reasons, legitimate, illegitimate, nefarious, or benign. They loved that, and somehow that outstripped the sort of traditionalist, you know, view of the humanities. Now, it didn't completely do it because there's still people like us, and there are other people we know that teach it, but this thing didn't get a foothold through nefarious conspiratorial things. It got mm-hmm. a foothold because somehow, some way, the people who taught it loved it.
Right. And in their love for it, it also had a sort of cohesion to it. I mean, yeah. People are looking for a worldview. They're looking for a kind of cohesive way of understanding the world. And the materialist viewpoint tries to do that.
Right.
And so if they buy into these sorts of ideologies and are enthusiastic about them, well, then it's understandable why, on one hand, people are drawn to it, but also, secondly, why they started reinterpreting everything about the society they're born into in light of that.
Right.
But I think it's steered us away from that whole spiritual aspect of life that makes the truth ring.
Right. And it's,
ring true.
And I'm thinking, it's like, we need professors who love the humanities because they're the humanities, not because of anything else.
That's right.
They need to love Spencer because Spencer is awesome.
Yeah.
And what is said in The Faerie Queen is awesome. And if you're stepping into a world. Because what happens is that the thing that usually gets love, the ideological whatever, there are people who will love that, but that ideological thing is very narrow and small.
That's correct.
And so it only appeals to a small group of people. So what happens is that you still have people who are really enthusiastic about this stuff. Okay, they are. They get inspired. But the pool shrinks because it's no longer speaking to the whole of humanity. It's just shrinking to people who agree with that one political side of
things. That's right. And I think it shrinks that, the group, but it also shrinks the individual. Mm-hmm. So that we have a whole part of ourselves that doesn't actually get addressed.
Right.
And the humanities are supposed to address that.
Right.
Do you think that it's because? Do you think it's that by losing the idea of the image of God in man, that we then can lose the enthusiasm for those things that are human?
Yeah, I think
humanity.
I think it's directly connected to mm-hmm. it. The loss of the image of God is connected to the loss of the sort of spiritual reality of human beings. The big enemy, you know, aside from like an irrational spiritualism, I think the big enemy for Christianity or even just right thinking, period, is materialism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The philosophy, not just the consumerist view of things,
right.
But like the philosophy
right.
that all there is matter and energy. Because a lot of the ideological narrow thinking is directly informed by a Marxist thought. Whether it's fully Marxist or just inspired by it, it owes a lot to it. And Marxism is fundamentally materialist. And as such, it fundamentally denies a whole sector of the human person.
That's it. If you can redefine those invisible characteristics, falling in love or feeling emotions or thinking thoughts themselves, ideas, if you can redefine those things in material terms, and in a sense, explain them away, as Lewis calls it, bulverism.
Right.
You know, he talks about Ezekiel. He made up a person called Ezekiel Bulver who created this thing of seeing through things, is saying love is only chemical reactions in the brain or something like that.
The direct example used in the essay was the lady who says to her husband, oh, you just said that because you're a man.
Because you're a man, sure. That's right. He calls it a bulverism.
Right.
That's our concern. Of course, if you can see through everything to what you really know what it's all about, it's a kind of cynicism. It's a reductive kind of cynicism, and it eventually erases everything to such a degree that you then can't see anything at all.
And you're right that it erases the image of God in the process
immediately,
and the result is that human beings. It's so sad. And I don't know how to sound put that without it sounding condescending. But it, being in the academic world that I was and seeing with the students who I were, they genuinely care about people and they want them to be okay. But the worldview they have in fundamentally denies the spiritual side of things, and thus fundamentally denies the spiritual part of human beings or the spiritual aspect of human beings, the spiritual substance of human beings. And in doing so, you've already dehumanized them. If you want to make it as complex as you can, you can say they're just vectors of intersecting data or something like that. That's abstract and metaphysical as you get. And even that, it's just reductionistic. There's a very small swath. This is what happens, okay? Why do people get... Either you go into the university and you study these humanities, and either you're 90 to 95% of the people who just get completely uninspired with this purely materialist, emptied out, dehumanized version of things, which is just uninteresting and unfun, all right? Or you're one of the 10 to 5% that just get jazzed by this whole Marxist view of the world. That's what happens. That's what I think happens. And it's that narrowing of it down to where the enthusiasm is all based in a purely materialist view of the world rather than the larger material and spiritual, that these things are conducting
that's
both
correct.
At the same time, I think is probably caused the biggest damage. And I feel like that's something a lot of analysis ignore. You can talk about those darn leftists all you want, like, you know, stepping in. But if we don't realize that you can't just replace it with some non-leftist but still materialist view of things.
That's right.
You know, and just as you can't replace it with a formalist kind of view of things, well, we're going to teach this stuff. Why? Well, because it's good. Well, why? Because we say so, or something like that.
Right.
It has to connect. It has to connect to a spiritual reality that's real, and it has to connect to the earth in some way. And I think the enthusiasm for the ideologically reduced version of the humanities we have in a lot of major universities is that it's connected to the earth.
Right.
You know, what you're reading has direct implication for, you know, what's going on in the news. You know, Shakespeare was all about, you know, the divisions in, you know, the English wars or the religious wars across England, across Europe. Well, that's just like tribalism today, you know, like wouldn't be the same sort of. They got something like that, but there's no spiritual connection. There's no like connection back to, well, there's this. There's the ordo amoris, there's the cosmos, you know, the great arranging and beautifying of existence that's based in the moral order, that's based in the very essence of God. There's nothing like that that gives a deeper substance to it and richness to it.
And if you lose that, you lose the idea of ethics, too.
Yes.
And so in a materialist system, see, we lose our philosophy of ethics, but we don't lose the reality of the sinful world.
Right. We
know, you know, there still is evil about, and we have to explain it somehow. And so just like we try and explain love as chemical impulses or electrical impulses in the brain or whatever, chemical relations, we have to make material arguments for virtue. So I think that's how we get to the point where we turn... we call immoral behavior immoral based on the fact that it is an injustice in material wealth, say, or material well-being. And more I'm convinced, by the way, that this is only possible in a post-Christian society because the desire to help the poor, the desire to help the needy, to somehow equalize outcomes, is misguided, but not wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's I think we want, there's something in our hearts still in this post-Christian society that says the little guy, the underdog, needs to be cared for. Mm-hmm. And if we're not doing that, then we're being immoral somehow. We can't put our finger on it except that it's accepted throughout the society that that's the way to go. The problem is we can't get rid of evil in the world. We see that there's evil, but we can't explain it away by our materialist philosophy unless we reduce evil to a kind of material lack. Mm. And then we can say, well, it's wrong of this country to take more than that country, or it's wrong to allow one group to have more resources than another one, I mean, right. Because all human beings. But the weird thing is, in places that where there were no Christian influences or small Christian influences, like India, for example, the societal desire to care for the poor is missing. Mm-hmm. They don't actually care for the poor. The strange thing is they step over each other in the street as they die. You know, there's a serious lack of appreciation for the underdog, the sick, the needy, the poor, the... Those guys are suffering from the karma that from another life, maybe something like that, and you can't get in the way of right. that karma.
And if there is some kind of care, it's foundationally imported from a Christian world.
I think so.
If there are hospitals or universities or orphanages or charities, it's probably grounded in something that was imported from, you know, when England was there or something like that.
Yeah, or seeing Mother Teresa living down the street, living there and doing it, and then being astonished. I remember my friend Vishal telling me the story about how he and his wife came to America. He had come to America many times, but when he brought her for the first time, these are two Christians who are from India, they were driving along, and an ambulance came up behind them, flashing lights and so on, and everybody dutifully on the highway pulled off to the side to let the ambulance fly by. And when he was pulling back onto the road and looked over at his wife, she was weeping. Mm-hmm. And he said, "What is it? What is it?" And dear Ruth, she's this lovely lady, she said, "I just can't imagine, I never imagined a country where all of the well people would get out of the way so that the one sick person could get where he needed to go, you see, to the hospital." That was so foreign to her. Mm. And we just take it for granted, you see. So there are remains of a Christian understanding of the importance and the dignity of every individual that lives on, even among the ideologically left of our materialist, ideologically left world.
And it's sort of the tragedy of the bankruptcy of their position when it fully cashes out. You know, if you really did accomplish whatever material goal you're trying to do, you know, we really did equalize wealth. Now everybody's getting exactly the same and it's all fair. Now what?
Right.
Right. There is no answer. To all my Marxist-influenced or inspired Marxist people, I just speak a bit pugilistically. I dare you to try and give me an answer that does not contradict your viewpoint flatly. Because materialism ultimately ends in the exact same boat. Marxist materialism ends in the exact same boat that a capitalist materialist society ends. Mm-hmm. That is, well, you got the wealth and you got it properly. Now what do you do with it? I don't know.
Sure.
Just do what you want. There's no answer to that. Do as you please, I guess. And it's like at that point where it's like, well, what is the meaning of my life? What is the meaning of the uses of my wealth? What is all this for? There is no answer because there's no metaphysic backing the ethic. Or if there is a metaphysic, it's a purely material one that cannot support anything beyond the material.
And but you can be blinded to that as long as there is an inequality.
Yes, and I think that's part of the problem is that living in a fallen world where the poor will always be with us, there is always inequality to fight, and thus there's always that enthusiasm. There's always this inspiration. You never get to the point where, you know, the utopia, or not even the utopia, like just the inequality is taken care of, everybody's now equal, and then you suddenly realize, well, wait a minute, you know, Steve Pinker wrote an essay summarizing his book about Enlightenment Now or whatever, which I criticized because, you know, big deal that I criticized it, but I criticized it because he basically said, like, we know that we've done such great things and great progress and everything's actually getting better. Well, how do we know? Well, because we have iPhones now. It was like we have air conditioning.
Yeah.
And it was like there was no thought to, or even important things like, well, illiteracy is way up all over the world, but there was no thought to what are you doing with your iPhone? Mm-hmm. Or what are you doing inside your air-conditioned house?
What are you reading?
Like, there was no thought to that whatsoever. It's almost like that stuff was unimportant. And I don't see how everything influenced by materialism, which includes his kind of brand of enlightenment stuff, and including the Marxist brand of enlightenment stuff, and everything that's been influenced by Marxism, all the ideological apparatus that is shanghaied the humanities for so long, I don't see how it won't just cash out the same way. Mm-hmm. How do we know we're better? Well, now we all have equal wealth. Well, what do you do with your wealth? I don't know. Well, we all have it equal now. That's not good enough. It's not good enough. Your ethic of just everybody has the same materiality in equal proportion is not a good enough ethic.
So that's the sort of thing that a liberal arts education could teach you. How to establish the ordo amoris, what to love the most, what to love the least, and how much this should be loved more than that. And it needs to be a kind of, like you said at the very beginning, a rational set of loves. It's an ordered loves. It's not just a subjective, purely subjective, personalized, relativized thing. And there is a world out there to know and to love. And it needs to be getting that order of loves in right order would give you the answer to the question of what do you do now?
Yeah.
But it also gives you an answer to the question of how to handle money.
Yeah.
Or how to see the material world, right. And how to treat one another and so on.
And it's also why you need the teacher or the professor, because the rational loves, the ordo amoris, the loving the right things, it has to be known experientially. Like, you have to experience it.
Right, right.
And part of experiencing it is reading a book, okay, that is an experience of that, which is its own discussion. But more importantly, because you don't know the way and you don't know how to love it, is you have someone else who does love it and love it the right way, who kind of not just guides you through it, but is like their love for this thing becomes its own sort of biosphere that you step into when they open the book. And it doesn't feel like you're just getting a formal thing or instruction or something. You feel like you've stepped into a new world.
Yes.
And when you step into that world, that's when things can change. When you step into that, then things change. The big example we always use is one of our former students, who we will not name, though if he's listening, he'll know who he is, was one of my favorite students of all time because he was a giant, you know, he was a giant nerd and a cynical millennial, internet savvy millennial who thought socialism was cool, probably still thinks it's cool. But I loved him to death because he would ask hard questions and he seemed to actually care about this stuff. And there was a moment where on our trip to Europe, where I've told this story before, so if I repeat myself, I don't care. We went to Europe, and one of the things we do is we go to Paris, and we take him to Notre Dame. And he was really jazzed about going into Notre Dame because he wanted to go in there and, like, hum the Castlevania theme because it's very gothic inside there, and he thought it would be perfect. And I'm like, you know what? That's a brilliant reason for going into Notre Dame. Let's do this. So all of us go in there, and he's with me, and I can hear him humming it, and it's a lot of fun. But then we get to the central part of the cathedral where all the points intersect, and he like walks out, and it opens up at that point, and he turns, and he sees the North Rose window lit up by the sun.
Yeah.
And he just stops dead in his tracks, and he just has to stand there for like 10 or 12 minutes and just look at it and take it in. And it just, that changed him in some way. And it's that. It's like you as the teacher have to in some small way become a sunlit rose window in the room. Or you have to somehow make your classroom into a cathedral with rose windows that the sun can hit in
some way. That's it.
You have to create that sort of space. And part of creating that space is loving the thing that you teach, because what the thing you teach shows is the thing that you love.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Right. And that young man said something like, now that I've seen this, I have to rethink everything.
Yeah.
I have to reconsider. One time I was walking through Notre Dame, talking about Notre Dame, I was walking through with my wife, and not too many years into our program, and of course she is an art history major and is very appreciative of great architecture and beauty of art and so on. But she said to me, we were looking at the ambulatory in Notre Dame behind the choir. Behind the choir in the apse there, mm-hmm. at the little chapels, and they are so exquisite and so profound, and the lighting is so gorgeous, and the windows are so beautiful, and the sculpture is so beautiful, and the story of Jesus is being told throughout, you know. And she just stopped and looked around, and she said to me, is this what you mean when you say we have to preserve and convey Western civilization? And I said, this is it. Yes, this is what I mean. And she looked at me very deeply, and she said, then we're doing the right thing. Mm. This is important. And it's for that very reason you're talking about with our student seeing the rose window. And it happens in reading Dante. It happens, mm-hmm. For others, it happens in reading Conrad, Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness. It happens when they see paintings. I know one of our young girl students saw the painting, Rembrandt's painting of the woman caught in adultery. Mm-hmm. I think it's at the National Gallery in London. And she stood in front of that forever and couldn't believe how beautiful it was and how profound it was and how spiritually moving it is, because Rembrandt invites you in to participate with this girl. You know, she's the center and the light is shining on her, but it's also shining on him. And his compassion for her is so clear, you know. Rembrandt has made him look so loving and compassionate toward the sinner. And there's no, as you know the story, there's no doubt that she's a sinner. It's just a question of whether or not she's going to be stoned to death. And Jesus' response is so compassionate. It doesn't deny, it's profound too, it doesn't deny the law or the commandment to stone. It just asks to put things in perspective. You know, any of you who is without sin can cast the first stone. And that comes out in that painting so profoundly. And she, I think, was really changed by that. It's beautiful to see that kind of thing right. In our year. I look forward to that moment in each of our students every year.
Everything in the humanities, every book, every painting, every piece of music is its own stained glass window that can catch the sunlight.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to be the one who brings your students into that cathedral, and maybe hope and work and pray mm-hmm. that they catch a glimmer of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's wrap up.
Sure. You got anything to recommend?
Yeah, well, I do want to recommend this one article by Victor Davis Hanson on what he calls the humanities move off campus. This is from some years ago, but it was printed in the City Journal, mm-hmm. And you can find it there if you look up cityjournal.com. And he talks in there about the importance of the things we've been talking about, the liberal arts education.
For me, something more dorky. Did you know there is a power metal band named Blind Guardian?
Huh.
That's been around since the 80s.
Okay.
And into the late 80s and into the 90s, they found their true calling, which is basically taking stories and writing songs about the stories, but they're power metal songs. And they had one album in the early 90s that had like a song about Blade Runner and a song about the Discworld novels and a couple of songs about the Chronicles of Narnia.
My goodness.
And they don't try to like flip it or subvert it or stuff. They just make a song about the thing. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in the late 90s, they made a power metal album called Nightfall in Middle Earth that is a power metal concept album of the Silmarillion. There are songs on there that are about Morgoth arguing with Ungoliant. There's
Good
a song
night.
About Fëanor condemning the Noldor to
yes.
their long trip.
Yes.
There's a beautiful, quiet piece called The Eldar, which is about the death of Finrod when
oh,
he
yes.
saved Beren. Mm-hmm. There's Fingolfin's stand against Morgoth. There's Hurin getting put in the chair and Morgoth telling him he's going to be saved. There's like all these songs and little vignettes in between them that are like either sung or spoken, sometimes straight from the Silmarillion. And there's no attempt to be clever. There's no attempt to like flip it on. It's just songs based on the Silmarillion. And it's all power metal,
for heaven's sake.
And it's so much fun. It's just me. So if you are someone who loves Tolkien and you love really awesome rock, apparently Blind Guardian is super famous, like they're foundational. But if you love that stuff, then go find their album. That's the only album I can vouch for. I can't vouch for anything else they've done. But it's called Nightfall in Middle Earth. And the cover of it is Morgoth's throne room where Luthien, I think she like sang to him or something like that. But it's that image of him sitting in there.
Good night.
So that's what
I got to hear that.
That's what I recommend.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, thank you all for listening.
Thank you, guys. And we'll see you next time.
Very good.